From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. If there is a cultural war going on in Utah, members of the organization FAIR could be seen as kind of intellectual warriors on the side of Mormonism. Founders created the organization in response to what they saw as unanswered criticism of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints floating around on the internet. Members of the organization are defenders of the faith, and it could be said that faith has been taking some hits lately, with the publication of a number of books that raise questions about the origin of Mormonism and the behavior of early leaders. The members of FAIR have taken to the books to offer a kind of spirited response that doesn't often come from the official ranks. Today in the program, we're getting their view on the religious divide in Utah. We'll talk about how they see their role and explore their strategy for fighting back. Defending Mormonism, after this news. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Most of the time, officials of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints stay out of the fight that is raging about the origin of Mormonism and the nature of the faith. It's not as if the church doesn't offer its side of things when criticism is particularly public, but much of this battle is being waged in the background, in obscure academic papers and on the internet. Leaders like to stay away from the particulars of these debates, which seem to be frustrating in some ways to the faithful, those itching to defend themselves and their way of life. It's not as if some of the faithful have stayed out of the fray. One organization designed to defend the positions and beliefs of Mormonism was created to respond to the criticism. The group is called FAIR, the Foundation for Apologetic Information and Research. It's just held its fifth annual conference, and today on the program we're talking about their role in the Utah cultural battle and their strategy for fighting back. We hope you'll join the conversation with a question or a comment. You can call us. 585-WEST is the number, 585-9378. Our email address is radiowest@kuer.org. Joining us in the studio here this morning is Lance Starr. He's the Media Relations Director for the Foundation for Apologetic Information and Research. We'll just call them FAIR throughout the program, although I'll make it clear what that stands for from time to time. Lance Starr, welcome. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Doug. Thank you for having me.
Lance Starr is also a law student at Brigham Young University's law school, by the way, and also here by phone with us is Kevin Barney. Kevin Barney is a lawyer talking to us from his office in Chicago, Illinois. He is on the board of FAIR. And Mr. Barney, welcome to you.
Thank you very much, and good morning, Doug.
Good morning. Well, gentlemen, let me ask you, I'm interested in the origins of FAIR, first of all. What was going on in the culture, do you think, that made you want to create a kind of organization like this? Did you have a sense that something in particular was at stake, that the church in some ways was being threatened, do you think?
Well, Kevin's been around longer than I have. He's probably been around since the inception, but I would say the biggest thing was the advent of the internet. You had just an explosion of information about the church on literally hundreds of websites, and then you also had the advent of the bulletin boards, the AOL bulletin boards, where people had very heated debates about religious topics, not just our church, but every church, every religious doctrine was being debated heavily. And just that new form of communication, I think, gave rise to it. Kevin can probably speak to the particulars of how FAIR came about.
Yeah.
Well, Lance is right. I was not around at the very beginning, but FAIR was a conception that came to fruition maybe 7 years ago. And it was specifically the AOL message boards and discussions people were having about the church at that time. And so a group of people decided to organize, and that's how FAIR was born.
Was this desire to organize a kind of, I'm not sure how to characterize it, but was it a sort of, you know, we're not taking this anymore, We're gonna fight back. I've said fight back, but I'm not sure it's entirely accurate.
Well, I think originally that was kind of the sense of as you say, we're not going to take this anymore.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think there was kind of a fight back spirit at first. Although over time, I think FAIR has moved away from kind of confrontational mode, although some individuals may do that, to more of an educational function. To educate members and investigators about this literature.
The other thing I would think is there was also a need, you know, you say we didn't have to take anymore. And the point was we didn't have to take it anymore. There were good answers out there to a lot of these criticisms that were being bandied about. The problem was is, especially on the message boards, somebody would post a very good answer in one spot, and within a couple of weeks that answer would be lost into the cyberspace. So I think they saw a need to have a central clearinghouse for this information so that people didn't have to go searching through 100 books to go back and invent the wheel again to find that answer. And I think that's what the Internet really provided, was a really easy way to provide a central location where answers to these questions could be found. And I think part of that was, is, you know, these answers were coming out there, and people said, you know, it's not only a sense of I don't have to take this anymore. There are answers to this material. There's answers to these problems. There's answers to these questions. We just need to have a place where people can find them.
And we might point out that the FAIR website is at fairlds.org, and that is kind of the repository that Lance was referring to.
Yeah, it is.
I know that that neither of you were there at the very onset of the organization, but what are you seeing? What were they seeing in particular that characterized the things that were on the Internet? I mean, were they particularly nasty or just misinformed, or what was it that troubled?
I think it probably ran the gamut. Yeah. It still does. A lot of it started out with an evangelical Christian versus LDS type of debate, and that's where a lot of it started out with. Over the past few years, it's kind of moved away from that. It's actually become more of a secular type of versus LDS debate. But I think that's probably where it began. Was some of it was nasty. Some of it's really very mean-spirited.
Now, by evangelical versus Mormon, are you saying that the evangelicals say Mormons aren't Christians? They're questions
exactly
about how they perceive God.
And that's probably where most of it began, was from that camp.
And we should just clarify that it's a fairly narrow strand of evangelicals that are you know, this type of what they call counter-cultist. I mean, most evangelicals, don't give Latter-day Saints, a second thought. So we throw around the label evangelical, but we mean that only to refer to a very narrow, stripe of Christian.
So what do you mean, though, Lance, sir, that it's moved sort of away from that to some degree to the more secular? Is this in the sort of – because there seems to be a lot of criticism – I don't think it's entirely new, but from certain circles about religion in general, the stuff you hear that it, can't be supported by science, that it spawns intolerance and hatred and bigotry.
And that's where a lot of, you talk about the Krakauer book.
Yeah.
Is one that comes readily to mind.
Should mention John Krakauer.
John Krakauer, under the banner of heaven.
Right.
And it should be pointed out that he's just not, his book, the theme of his book is not just about Mormons. It's about religion in general. He uses Mormonism as an example for his thesis.
Yeah.
But he's coming from the perspective of someone who, I guess you'd call a non-believer, which is fine. I mean, that's as valid a perspective as any to come from. But that's where you see a lot of it coming from nowadays. Another example is the DNA stuff that came out in the past year. That originally originated from a non-believing standpoint, I guess you would call it.
Explain what you mean by the DNA stuff, though.
The DNA stuff is basically about 2 years ago, there was a study that came out in an anthology that was published here locally, that it was basically a survey of some of the DNA research that had been done in Mesoamerica, South America areas, and trying to determine whether they could find what you would call Israelite DNA among the Amerindians, because one of the LDS claims is that there were a group of Israelites who migrated from Jerusalem to the Americas. And so there was some thought that maybe you could prove that point by finding DNA. And obviously those DNA studies did not support that, which to most informed LDS, I guess you'd say scholars, didn't come as a big shock, because we really didn't expect that. But because of popular a belief in LDS culture, there were a lot of people who did expect that, mainly because they had the idea that every Native American was a descendant of this group that came from Jerusalem.
Yeah. We should mention that, of course, there's another group of scholars and intellectuals who gather in August to talk about issues of Mormonism, the Sunstone Symposium.
Mm-hmm.
You make it clear that you're different, and I'm wondering in what ways.
Well, I think part of the difference is we just have a narrower purpose. I was at Sunstone for one day. I've subscribed to the magazine for many years, and I personally am a supporter of Sunstone. But FAIR has a different purpose. Our purpose is narrower, and whereas Sunstone is a forum for kind of investigating things relating to Mormonism just from all angles, FAIR's purpose is more narrowly tailored to responding to anti-Mormon attacks. And so it's just there are two very different purposes.
What else do you make of the purposes, Lance Starr? I mean, one of the questions I wondered about was I saw on the website particular question that you were there to help. Was it bolster the faith of Latter-day Saints?
Yeah, that's really our audience, and I think Kevin alluded to this earlier. We really don't aim our material at the critics. What we do is we're aiming our material at people who have been affected by those arguments. I can give you an example. I got a call from my wife's uncle just last night. People in their ward had been exposed to some anti-Mormon material, and it had caused them to have some second thoughts. FAIR's purpose is to have ready answers available so you can say, look, yes, this is what they are saying. Here is a very plausible answer to that critique. And that's really all we have to shoot for is plausibility. We don't have to have the exact right answer. We just simply have to show that critique is not necessarily dead on, that there are other options that they can have to maintain their faith.
So, but what do you? That's interesting you say that, because does that mean that for some people, all they need to maintain their faith is reasonable doubt of criticism?
In some cases, I think that's probably the case. Kevin may disagree with me, but I think that that's the case. And for example, in the DNA studies again, we've had several very highly qualified geneticists look at that question, and each of them have come back and said, we wouldn't expect to find what they're claiming we should find. It's just not. So what we've given is we said, look, the critique said there is no DNA. The response to that is, we didn't expect there to be any. That's a plausible response to a critique. We don't have to say where the DNA is at. We don't even have to explain where it came from or where it went to. We simply have to show this is why we didn't expect it to be there in the first place.
Yeah, reasoned discussion and rational discourse establishes an environment in which faith is able to flourish. And so that's something that we try to provide.
It's interesting also, Lance Starr, in the website, it's noted that on the question of blacks in the priesthood, that there are no clear answers to it, you say, to that question of why it was that the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints waited until 1978 to give all of the rights of Mormonism to black men. It says in the website something to the effect that you just have, and I'm wondering if you think you just have to be sort of content about the fact that there aren't necessarily answers all the time, and we'll just sort of do our best.
And that is the case a lot of the time. In the case of the blacks and the priesthood thing, there's several lines of thought in the church about how that came about. Some claim it was a revelation. Others claim it was just a cultural relic that somehow got ensconced in the doctrine. You know, you can choose and pick and choose whatever. Our position on that is probably we don't know how it came about, but we know how it ended. And that's really our focus on that point, is we know who ended it, at least from a Mormon perspective. We know who ended it, we know why it was ended, and we move on from that point.
Kevin, Barney, anything else to say about that particular point?
I'll just add that we're preparing a special webpage dealing with black Latter-day Saints, and we're trying to get some input from the Genesis group on that, and so that's something for people to look for in the future. We're going to have a tremendous amount of information, and some of it I think will deal with the historic issue of the blacks and the priesthood.
Another point I might make on that is the blacks and the priesthood issue is also an example of what really bad apologetics can do for you also. In that you had this problem, in that nobody knew why this ban or this doctrine had come about. And in that void, people tried to invent excuses or invent reasons to come, you know, because they wanted to be able to explain it, because it was a contentious issue for a lot of people. And a lot of those explanations they came up with were just not very good and were actually quite hurtful in a lot of ways.
And that's a problem we continue to have to deal with as a church, because, as Lance points out, a kind of folklore developed that in some circles continues to be circulated, and it's something that we have to try to eradicate.
So are you gentlemen saying then that you're not trying to sort of configure the details of the past to match your notion of Mormonism? If you lay out explanations that are available, if it's not, you're going to say, you know, we don't really know. Is that right?
Well, we're certainly not trying to configure the past to match our own modern perceptions. I think, whenever you look at history, you're to some extent bounded by your own, kind of cultural presuppositions. So we can't escape that. But there are issues in the past, and I think we try to deal with them openly. I like to say that sunshine is the best disinfectant. And a lot of times, it's the best thing we can do is to discuss something openly, but give people perspective about it. A lot of times, people will hear about some skeleton in the closet that they've never heard of before, and they hear it from an antagonistic source, and that can be damaging to their testimony. Whereas if they hear about it from a faithful source with explanation and context and often there's an extensive historical literature about it that they're not aware of, then, they can deal with that issue.
Kevin Barney is with us. He's on the board of FAIR. It's the Foundation for Apologetic Information and Research. He's speaking to us from his office in Chicago, Illinois. Here in studio is Lance Starr, the Media Relations Director for FAIR. We're inviting you to join the conversation, if you like, with a question or a comment. 585-WEST is the number, 585-9378. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. We're going to take a break. We'll be back in just a moment. This is Radio West on FM 90. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Over the past few years, there have been a number of challenges to the positions of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Some have been historical, some doctrinal. Today in the program, we're speaking with some of the members of an organization created to defend the church. They had a conference recently. We'll talk about their views of the way their church is being treated in the media and elsewhere. You can join us at 585-WEST, 585-9378. Our email address is radiowest@kuer.org. Lance Starr is with us. He is the Media Relations Director for the Foundation for Apologetic Information Research. They're called FAIR. Also here with us on the phone from his office in Chicago, Illinois, is Kevin Barney. He's on the board of FAIR. Let's first go to the phones, right to the phones. Claire has been waiting. She is joining us on the line. Claire, welcome to the program. Thanks.
Hi. My question today is, where does FAIR gather their information when responding to questions and criticism toward the church?
Boy, that's a broad question, because it really depends on what the question is. You know, if it's a historical question, we'll tend to go back to the historical documents. We have open lines of communication with, in the history question, we have open lines of communication with several LDS historians who can point us in the right direction. Kevin, can you think of anything else there?
Well, if you go to the FAIR website, on the left there's a button that says Topical Guide.
Mm-hmm.
And if you hit that button, there's like 50 kind of broad topics that are listed there.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you click on, like, say, First Vision, typically what you'll find are there might be an article or two written specifically by FAIR volunteers. There might be the article from the Encyclopedia of Mormonism. Typically, there will be three or four articles from the Ensign. There will be links to other material on the Internet. Mm-hmm. And then there will be references to print resources, books, mm-hmm. and that sort of thing.
And I guess these are pretty typical academic papers in that they're fully sourced and those kinds of things.
Yes.
Yeah. We're very careful with our sourcing. We have a peer review system that we've set up for materials that are submitted to us.
And sometimes, and people can, if they have a question, they can submit it to the webmaster at FAIR. We have a private apologetics email list of over 300 people from all over the world. And those questions get posted on the list, and people have all kinds of different experiences and different strengths. And generally, you know, two or three people will come up with a response or an answer. Or at the very least, we can at least point people in the right direction, say, you know, there's this article you should read and that sort of thing.
I wonder, though, gentlemen, do you direct them just in the interest of getting sort of a full-bodied view of all of the information? Do you ever direct them to people who offer sort of critical, or that's, you don't see that as your role?
To direct them to critics?
Yeah, or more critical views of, let's say a question comes related to the origins of the first vision, of mm-hmm. Joseph Smith's first vision. Now, you're going to offer what I expect would be sort of more apologetic views.
Well,
would you send them to someone who says, this is what I think?
Well, I would point out that, you know, there's this alternate view, you know, kind of established by Wesley Walters, and I might point them to the book Inventing Mormonism as an example of that alternate view, you know, co-authored by Michael Marquardt. And
but it's fair to say you're not really interested in that. I mean, you
most times when they come to us, they've come to us because they've already been exposed to that position.
We're using the second line. They've
had that bad experience. Some critic has raised that question in their minds, and so they're coming to us for the alternate view.
Claire, we're glad you called. Thanks very much. 585 West, again the number, 585-9378. Nick is with us on the phone. Nick, welcome.
Yeah, I wondered what their explanation was for the Kinderhook plates and for the Book of Abraham.
Okay, you know, I sort of knew this was going to go into minutia, and there's nothing wrong with that. Is there a way for you to, is it going to take us 20 minutes to explain what that is?
You know, it would, because those are both very broad topics. If you'd like to know, if you go to our website and hit that topical guide key under the cage, you'll find several explanations of the Kinderhook plate episode. I happen to know Kevin has some expertise in the Book of Abraham, but I suspect Kevin would, you know, it's a very large topic. It requires a lot of speciality.
The Book of Abraham is a huge topic. So we have kind of introductory information on our website. We also, you know, are supporters of FARMS, the Foundation for Ancient Research and Mormon Studies at Brigham Young University. And they have kind of more detailed scholarly publications available. FAIR uses scholarship, but most of us are not scholars. Most of us are, you know, just ordinary Latter-day Saints. So often our function is to kind of point people to the scholarship that does exist.
Nick, I don't want to put off the question, though. Is there something in particular that we could respond to in this forum?
Well, apparently not. I mean, they say it's too big to handle.
The
papyrus was found from the Book of the Dead.
The Kinderhook plate,
and out of this you get the Book of Abraham, which just doesn't comport with any scholarship at all. I mean, the Book of Abraham either came by revelation or invention. It certainly didn't come from the Book of the Dead.
All right, well, there's sort of a brief sense of it. Lance, you want to make a brief
On the
response?
Book of Abraham, I'd say his argument is an oversimplification because we simply don't know if we have all the Book of Abraham materials or not. There's actually some good historical evidence that what was recovered, I believe it's back in the 70s, is not the complete set of papyri that Joseph Smith had. Even if it is, there are several – and I that's personally my position. I don't think – based on the descriptions we have of the material that Joseph Smith had back at that time versus what we have now – I do not see the correlation. There are other people who
not on the Kinderhook plates
in the book, reprinted in the book of Abraham, came right off of the Book of the Dead scroll Dr. Tia found in the Metropolitan Museum.
I think Nick, it's fair to say most of us don't really know what either of you guys are talking about. So I'm going to move on. We're going to go with some more broader questions.
If Nick would like to continue that conversation, he's certainly welcome to drop us an email at FAIR and. We can continue that conversation, and that's one of the things we do is, you know, via email, we can continue the conversation that way.
Let's take another call. Craig is joining us on the line from Salt Lake. Craig, welcome.
Thank you.
Sure.
I just have a general comment, I guess, and it would be that The degree of latitude that these two gentlemen refer to when they speak about blacks and the priesthood and all that might have been a cultural artifact and what we did or didn't shouldn't expect out of DNA evidence is not the same degree of latitude that the church shows towards many issues of the day. Feminism, gay rights, there's a whole host of them. They approach these things in very black and white, Boyd K. Packer-esque terms. And so, therefore, I think that the same standard that the church uses should be used by critics of the church, to be perfectly frank. I mean, there's the. I don't know what your comment is there.
Yeah, Lance Starr, anyone respond?
I guess my position on that would be, you know, the church's stand on a certain issue of feminism, to my mind, doesn't go to the truth claims of the church one way or the other. You know, whether the church's modern position on a particular feminist issue has any bearing on the truthfulness of the church's religious claims, I don't see the correlation between the two there.
I'll also point out that FAIR is an independent organization. We are not formally or otherwise affiliated with the church, and so our take on things, you know, may not be what you would get in a church news editorial. But that's okay. We're independent and
okay. But members of the church are conditioned towards a black and white approach to questions.
But the fact that Kevin and I are here is a direct repudiation of that point. Kevin and I are both highly faithful members of the church.
You know what I'm talking
members of the
about
church,
here.
And I have not been conditioned that way. Kevin has not been conditioned that way. So when you use the word conditioning, that I disagree with that.
Are you
that
saying
type
that
of
the church doesn't generally condition people to think in very vivid, contrasting terms about issues?
That's not been my experience.
Well, let me ask you, Craig, if I may, sort of go off of your question. You make it clear, Kevin Barney and Lance Starr, that the organization has nothing to do with the official Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. But what do you make of the fact that leaders are fond, are they not, of admonishing members to sort of stay away from this kind of thicket of doctrinal minutiae, critical questions? It seems that they make the point that if it really doesn't affect your salvation, your eternal salvation, that you shouldn't waste your time with it, that it's in fact detrimental, dangerous to your testimony. So in that sense, how do you respond to Craig's question? Because
I think for most people that's good advice, but the problem is what happens when, you know, your sister-in-law or your niece or someone is exposed to this. Someone somewhere has to be able to respond and to deal with it. There's no need for everyone to go out and try to be an apologist, and most people will go throughout their lives and never have to give this sort of literature a second thought. But if it comes and touches you or someone you love, then someone needs to be able to respond. And so there is a need for someone to step up and to deal with this sort of minutiae.
Craig, anything else to say?
Just one other thing, and that is that I have every respect for the accomplishments of the LDS Church. And I just have nothing but total regard for people who dedicate themselves the way they do. But I think the church paints themselves into a corner when they make your participation in the church conditional on your acceptance of supernaturalism. And that's become a problem for me. I mean, I would like to pitch in there. I really would like to participate more, but I have utterly no interest in supernaturalism whatsoever.
Craig,
well,
most
theists tend to be supernaturalists to some extent. I mean, you can't prove the existence of God, so supernatural means beyond nature, and the existence of God is a claim that in and of itself is supernatural.
What do you mean, Craig? Yeah, I'm sort of curious. I mean, we've lost him. Sorry. Forgive me if I did that. 585 West is the number, 585-9378. Let me ask you, gentlemen, how do you define the term anti-Mormon? And I wonder if you put them in categories.
I think we certainly do categorize them. I don't know, Kevin.
I was going to say defining the term is very difficult.
Well, let me ask it this way. When I think of categories, I think of sort of intentionally bent on undermining the official Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. And then the other is where I would wonder if you, for example, would put someone like John Krakow or maybe even Will Bagley or someone in the category in that they are journalists or historians. They've written books that are sort of contrary to official views of Mormonism. They're maybe not out to maybe you think intentionally undermine Mormonism, but they in some way unintentionally may have.
In my mind, someone like Krakow, I would not classify him as an anti-Mormon.
I think you know, if someone disagrees, you know, with the church on an issue or something like that, that is not being anti-Mormon, and that's why it's so difficult because. You know, it's a hard line to draw, and we often refer to the line by Justice Stewart on pornography that I may not be able to define it, but I know it when I see it. And it's the same way with anti-Mormonism. And we tend to use the term more for those who are bent on, you know, their goal is to destroy the church.
And those who will use dishonest means to do so, you know, blatantly ripping quotes out of context, falsifying information in some cases. That to me is real anti-Mormon. I have no problem with somebody who wants to disagree with me and my positions. You know, I realize that Mormonism is a minority view, and I realize that there's a lot of people out there who have some views that are very opposite to what I believe. And as long as they hold those views, and that's fine, as long as they represent my views fairly, that's, you know, when I got into this whole thing, that's what I really had the biggest problem with, was my views were being distorted so that they could make their points.
Yeah, so there's a difference between responsible disagreement and, you know, cheap and dirty tricks to you know, the end justifies the means kind of attitude.
585 West is the number if you'd like to join the conversation, 585-9378. Let's go to Ray, who's waiting on a cell phone. Ray, welcome.
Hello?
Hi.
Hi. Hey, I'm really enjoying the conversation. We're a recent transplant family from Utah. We are not LDS. I did recently read John Krakauer's book, Under the Banner of Heaven, and I found it fascinating. I felt like it was a source of information that I cannot find where I am currently living that gives the other perspective of the history of the church. My question, I have two. One is, I love that you asked, what is anti-Mormon? I wish that there was a better definition of that. Maybe you could define that a little better.
Do we.
I think there is responsible disagreement, but I have found it very interesting that Paul in the New Testament says to earnestly contend for your faith. But when I have had missionaries come to my door and I've invited them in and I've listened and then they have asked questions, I have been told, oh, I feel a spirit of contention here and we're going to leave. So I guess I would ask, are you anti-Mormon if you say, absolutely, no, I don't agree, because I think that many people would say the very thing that you said, that we feel like the Scripture has been distorted and that Scripture is taken out of context. So I would love to find a forum where things can be discussed in a responsible manner. That's why I love listening to this show. So my question is, can you delineate Mormon is, can you what your thoughts are on John Krakauer's recent book?
I didn't catch her first question there. She faded out.
It sounded like she wanted a little more delineation of the expression anti-Mormon. Anti is a Latin prefix, which means against. And so it's very vague because, you know, if you speak against Mormonism on some limited subject, in one sense, yeah, you're anti-Mormon, but I think the way the term is more commonly thought of is it's someone who is actively attacking the church. You know, it might involve a ministry, you know, someone who's devoting their professional life to attacking the church.
Well, Ray, right. We didn't catch that last part. Go ahead, say that again.
You would say that Bill McKeever is definitely an anti-Mormon, someone who has started a ministry specifically devoted to completely destroying anything that the Mormon Church stands for. Is that correct?
Yes,
that's correct. Bill McKeever would certainly fall within that definition?
You know, something I have to say I've been challenged with here is when we moved here, I didn't want to read specific things against the Mormon Church, so I went and I purchased at Deseret Bookstore something for the – I cannot think of the name of the book. Oh, I'm sorry. My mind fails me. I cannot think of the book, but it was wonderful. It was a very good book. It was written for people who have been accused of being anti-Christian, who are LDS. I'm very open to reading history about the Mormon Church from a Mormon perspective, but I find it very challenging to get anybody to really talk to me about some of the maybe questionable histories of the Mormon Church. No one will really do it, so I find myself looking outside the Mormon Church to answer some of those questions, such as John Krakauer's book. Is there a comment that you guys have about his book? I would sure like to hear it.
Well, first of all, when you talk about talking with missionaries, you have to understand that in our LDS tradition, missionaries tend to be 19 to 21 year olds, and they're there to proclaim a message, and they're not seminarians in the sense of a Protestant missionary, so they probably don't have extensive background in LDS history the way people might expect them to have. So if you want to have that kind of discussion, missionaries are probably not the best source. You might try to hook up with regular members of the church in your area, and in particular maybe someone affiliated with a university. They might be able to point you to someone in your area who has an interest in LDS history and LDS thought.
I suppose, though, Kevin Barney and Lance Starr, that it might make sense if Ray is looking for, as I said before, sort of the full-bodied view of, let's say, the Mountain Meadows Massacre, that John Krakauer may be one place, but your website also offers a review of that and has sort of, I guess it's in some ways an official refutation of the book, or anyway a review of the book. So
what's on our website is just kind of an adaptation of the review or response written by Richard Turley, which is on the church's official website. Pointing out that Krakauer is a wonderful writer, but he's not an historian, and there are a lot of historical kind of gaffes and blunders with the book. I think if you're interested in the Mountain Meadows Massacre in particular, you might start with the classic book by Juanita Brooks out of University of Oklahoma Press. Of course, more recently, we have Will Bagley's Blood of the Prophets. But there's three LDS historians, including Richard Turley, are preparing a book that is due to come out of Oxford probably next year with full access to LDS archival material.
Yeah.
So I think people should, put that on their list. And when that book comes out, then we'll have, you'll have Brooks, you'll have Bagley, and you'll have Turley et al., and you'll have a wealth of sources and information to look at.
And Lance Starr, that's what you're saying, that it's okay to have the other stuff, but here's our side.
Exactly.
Yeah.
For example, Kevin mentioned Blood of the Prophets, the Bagley book, which, from all accounts, is an excellent book. And as a matter of fact, we at FAIR don't have a lot of problems with that book. We disagree with his conclusions, especially in regard to did Brigham Young have foreknowledge. We would disagree with those conclusions, and we have a few reasons why we disagree with that. But as far as Bagley's research and the work he put into it, he was fairly meticulous in that area.
Let me remind you, listening to Radio West here on FM 90, we're talking with members of the group FAIR, which is the Foundation for Apologetic Information and Research. Lance Starr is here in studio with us. He's the Media Relations Director for the organization. Kevin Barney is joining us from his office in Chicago, Illinois. He's on the board of FAIR. And let me bring into the group yet another voice. Scott Gordon is here. He's been waiting. He is joining us from Redding, California, where he teaches at Shasta College. He's the president of FAIR. And Scott Gordon, welcome. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much.
We invite you to join the conversation. 585-WEST is the number, 585-9378. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Let's go back to the phones. Jesse has been waiting on a cell phone. Jesse, thanks for waiting.
Thanks for taking the call, Doug. I really enjoy the show.
Thanks.
I'll be as brief as I can. I am a former member of the church. I left the church within the last year. And I've done extensive study into both the doctrines and the history of the church. I served a mission, and I guess what I really wanted to say, well, let me start with an example. A good friend of mine was attending a missionary homecoming last week, and the bishop stood up and he said, I would like to ask the members to go ahead and pray for those who have left the fold because they relied more on logic and reason to come to their conclusions about the church. And I had a chuckle about that because, I mean, honestly, that's what I did. And I think it comes down to a question of either you're going to rely on faith or you're going to rely on reason. And as Paul once said, faith is the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen. And in my own life, I really kind of come to consider that blind faith as opposed to faith that is actually merited by evidence and logic and reason. In Robert Greene's book, The 48 Laws of Power, in the 27th chapter, he basically outlines a perfect plan to create a cult or a religion or some type of religious entity which will allow you to kind of, you know, gain control over a group of people. And if you go through and study that chapter step by step, you can pretty much apply that to the LDS Church. And I know that sounds a little harsh, but
briefly,
know, I would challenge anybody to do that. Now, I just have one last thing to say. I think that the whole concept of Mormon scholarship, it kind of strikes me as a little ironic because at the end of the day, none of it can be proved. It all has to come down to faith.
Well,
and,
sir, you quote Paul.
Are
you still a believer in Jesus Christ, or are you an atheist now?
You know, people ask me, "Are you anti-Mormon?" And I would have to say, "I'm." That's just a little piece of the pie.
He didn't ask if you were anti-Mormon.
Do you believe in Jesus Christ?
Yeah.
I'm not
believer.
Do you
believe
in Jesus
God?
Christ, because I've also studied the historicity of that topic in some detail, and I'm no longer convinced of that.
Okay, Jesse
so
brings
why
up.
Why are you citing Paul? I'm not following.
I don't think she did. He did. Let me ask you this, Kevin Barney and Scott Gordon, join us on this question, which I think is a question you might agree on, which this idea that in fact it can't be proven. So why spend the resources on questions of DNA in the Book of Mormon, which the Mormon Church, we should say fairly, does spend a good number of resources in that end. Scott Gordon, to you, the question of faith, the role of faith in all of this.
Yes, and I agree that I actually agree with the caller in that is an issue of faith, that you can't prove the Book of Mormon is true, you can't prove the Bible is true, you can't prove God really exists. Certainly you can have evidences, but what is an evidence to me is not an evidence to somebody else. And so I might claim, oh, that proves it, but then somebody else looks at it and says, that's not enough for me. I think some of the issues that we have that FAIR deals with is specifically related to anti-Mormonism. When people are, like this gentleman, are looking for something to base their faith or non-faith on, their logic, and some of the sources are problematic. Just for an example, you know, I was looking at something on one of the Tanner's books.
We should mention the Tanners are
Gerald and Sandra.
Gerald and Sandra Tanner.
Well-known and critics of the Church of Jesus Christ.
Exactly. And what they have is whenever Mormons talk about things, I was looking at a study on one particular chapter, I think it was chapter 19 of their book, Changing World of Mormonism. And what they use is whenever Mormons talk, they claim, they admit, they confess, or they allege. But when anybody else's position is given, they affirm, they acknowledge, they say, or they testify. And so in the world of anti-Mormonism, sometimes it's loaded one way or the other. It's the bias, the polemic, you know, goes throughout the whole issue. Now, this particular gentleman who's lost his faith completely, you know, that's a little more difficult. That's something that's a personal issue that everyone has to deal with on their own.
585 West is the number if you'd like to join the conversation. Let's take a call from Toby, who's been waiting. Toby, welcome to the program.
Hello there. I guess I just have a question about the fact that you're more geared toward dealing with anti-Mormonism, but what about the people who do have faith and they believe in the church and they believe in often things that were taught early in the church and have problems with reconciling some of the things that are being said now? And I guess I know I have a few friends who believe in the Adam God doctrine, for example. They believe that that Adam is our Heavenly Father, and they are faithful members of the church. They hold temple recommends, and there are many who in the church who believe that that plural marriage is a necessity. And you can go back and find some of that literature. Joseph Fielding Smith, or Joseph F. Smith, said without equivocation that that it's a necessity. He says it's not superfluous. It's something that's necessary. But it's something that being taught today that that is non-existent, or that that we teach that it's not necessary.
And so, Toby, your question is, what about the person who wants to be a believer but has questions about the way the Mormon Church has evolved, has adapted?
No. Our believers, we believe that the church is true, but that maybe it's gone off track just a touch. And it may not be because of the leaders necessarily, but, I mean, in Isaiah it talks about it's because of the people who have gone astray, and so God takes things away from us. Now,
right. Toby, you made your point.
Gentlemen,
in the interest of time,
what we call fundamentalist attitudes, which is what I take it you're talking about. Frankly, more often we deal with, either evangelical or secularist critics. But we do have some dealings with a more fundamentalist mindset, and that actually is kind of a foundation for a lot of critical talk about the church, is that nothing can ever change, and so if a prophet in the 19th century said something, a later prophet cannot contravene that. And that's, we would call that a fundamentalist mindset.
And you also offer a response to that on your website, I guess, is the
so a lot of those issues we do, yeah.
Yeah. All right, 585 West is the number, 585-9378. Claire has been waiting on the line. Claire, welcome to the program.
Yes, hello.
Hi.
Hi. I just have a couple of quick comments. One, regarding the people who are staunchly anti-Mormon and go out of their way to tear down the church and make people come away. I guess my feeling is always they have way too much time on their hands. Why?
I agree too.
Why don't they spend the time building up their beliefs instead of tearing someone else down? That just has never made sense to me. And the other thing I have a comment on is that I am a convert to the LDS Church of about 15 years. I lived about 12 years in the Deep South, in Alabama, Georgia, North Carolina, South Carolina, right in the middle of the Bible Belt. I've lived also for 10 years in the San Francisco Bay Area, where it was just very, very liberal, and then here in Utah for the past 6 years. And it's very interesting to me how the culture affects people. And I've found living here in Utah County, actually, and living in the Deep South, there are many, many similarities culturally that I find people of the LDS Church who perhaps I tend to think have dug in their heels on certain points or just are convinced that they're right, very often have never left Utah. They've not really had a chance to mingle with other people, have experiences with people of other faiths or their beliefs or their lifestyles, whatever you have. And so I really do think the culture and culture and the gospel tend to get confused in my mind a lot of times.
I think you bring up an excellent point. I know I work at a college. And sometimes I've read things in the Utah papers where someone's complaining about something going on at BYU and talking about how the Mormon Church must be doing this or doing that, and I'm thinking, oh, the same thing's happening at my college. And so it does get confused. Whenever you have a predominant culture or a predominant group in any culture, then you get some people that participate just because it's a predominant group and don't really work at finding out if they believe in it or don't believe in it. And then you have people who just mistake everything that goes on in the culture as being influenced by the predominant group.
Yeah. Claire, we're glad you called. Thanks very much. 585 West, 585-9378. Denise has been waiting. Hi, Denise.
Hi. Thank you for letting me call. I appreciate your program.
Sure.
My question is very simple. Do these gentlemen believe that when they take an anti-gay stance and actively politic against gays, that they're also creating an environment where they're creating anti-Mormonism backlash as well?
It's a good question. Lance Starr, you want to take it?
Yeah, you got to remember the church has probably got there's probably two fronts the church is dealing with this homosexual issue on. You've got a political front, and then you've got members of the church who are dealing with this issue also. On the political front, you've got, and this is my own opinion on this, and from the study I've done, I've actually spent a little bit of time on this just through my law school work and things like that. The, I guess you'd call it the gay rights lobby, in my view, has been taken over by some rather radical elements of that lobby, and some of their goals and positions are just antithetical to LDS church positions. Gay marriage is one of them.
But
more so for us than
my
maybe...
point being, when you take that stand, you're creating an environment that goes against the gay community, and there is going to be a backlash against the Mormon Church regarding that.
That's her broader point, beyond the sort of particulars of how the Mormon Church regards homosexuality. It's the fact that taking a position, which they have to take, a legitimate, from their view anyway, position, has created what Denise is regarding.
And she's right.
Yeah.
And this, for us, but for every other church that takes a position on this one, especially a position that is one from, you know, like a conservative position, this is an issue that the church is going to be sidelined on for a long time to come.
And that's not something we had any control over. I mean, you know, it wasn't fair that it took a position. It was on the Defense of Marriage Act, you know, issues. I mean, that was the church itself. And so, that was not our call.
I agree with her. There is going to be a backlash. I don't know what we can do about it. It's part of the position that we're going to take. I mean, the church has to take that position. I think doctrinally and I think morally, it's obligated to take that position. Not just us. The Catholic Church is going to take that same hit. Any of the evangelical churches that take that position, they're all going to take that same hit.
Denise, so glad you called. I shouldn't do this, but we have barely time for one more. Jeremy's been waiting. Jeremy, welcome. Not much time.
Hello. Thank you.
Sure.
I've got a quick question. I just wanted to get your guests' responses. I was wondering what sort of reaction.
Oh, that's a shame. We lost Jeremy. Jeremy, so sorry. I haven't a clue as to where he was going with it, so forgive me. Maybe you can send an email. We'll try to get a response for you. Let me ask you, gentlemen, finally, all of you with us. There is a quotation from Brigham Young that you list on your website. I don't have the particular one here, it's in the heading of your website, and it essentially talks about the fact that criticism strengthens you. Do you know what I'm talking about, Lance Starr? You're looking puzzled.
No, I know the quote you're talking about, and I think, to a sense, criticism does strengthen you because it forces you to look at your beliefs and actually say, look, why do I believe this? It forces a deeper thinking in a lot of these things, and it forces someone to really examine their positions and say, why do I believe this?
I heard it once said that it takes a grain of sand irritating an oyster to create a pearl, and so sometimes you don't look at something very well you don't look at it until somebody actually brings up that, hey, I have a problem with this, and then that causes you to go and research it, look into it deeper, and in every case I've done that, I've been very gratified, and it's been a good experience for me. But, you know, it's a nice, you know, it can be a good thing.
And a few moments left for you, Kevin Barney.
Well, I think there's this idea I like to analogize to an inoculation. You know, when you get a shot, you're getting a small dose of the disease, but in a controlled way, and it makes it so that it immunizes you from a more virulent strain. So if you get exposed to, you know, something like, you know, the Kinderhook plates or something like that in a faithful environment, you know, with historical context, then down the line when someone slaps you in the face with it, with the idea of, you know, damaging your testimony, you won't be affected by it.
Kevin Barney, let me cut you off there. Forgive me.
That's fine.
Kevin Barney is a lawyer speaking to us from his office in Chicago, the Board of FAIR. Scott Gordon is the president. He spoke to us from his office at Shasta College in Redding, California. Lance Starr is the media relations director for the Foundation for Apologetic Information and Research, FAIR, a student at Brigham Young University. Gentlemen, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you, Doug.
Radio West is a production of KUER News. The program is produced by Ann Milliken. I'm Doug Fabrizio.